Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Hello and welcome back to New Books in Geography, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Steven Siegel, and it's my great pleasure today to have a truly distinguished professor of geography. I'm delighted to have today on our broadcast Mark Monmonier, who is the distinguished professor of geography at Syracuse University's Maxwell School of Citizenship and Public Affairs. Welcome, Mark, to our broadcast today.
Oh, thank you, Stephen. I appreciate being invited.
Mark has a new book which just came out with Esri Press. It's called Connections and Content, Reflections on Networks and the History of Cartography, just released. Mark has authored now 20 books, including his classic in its third edition, How to Lie with Maps. It first came out with University of Chicago Press in 1991. His other books include, and I'll just list some of them, Heir Apparent, How Meteorologists Learn to Map, Predict, and Dramatize Weather, Bushmanders and Bullwinkles, How Politicians Manipulate Electronic Maps and Census Data to Win Elections, I think especially relevant now, Spying with Maps, Surveillance Technologies and the Future of Privacy, Rumb Lines and Map Wars, A Social History of the Mercator Projection, From Squat Hit to Whorehouse Meadow, that has to be the greatest title ever, How Maps Name, Claim, and Inflame, Coastlines, How Mapmakers Frame the World and Chart Environmental Change, No Dig, No Fly, No Go, How Maps Restrict and Control, Lake Effect, Tales of Large Lakes, Arctic Winds, and Recurrent Snows, Adventures in Academic Cartography, a memoir, one of my favorites. And finally, Patents and Cartographic Inventions, a New Perspective for Map History. So today we'll be talking with Mark, whose books have been translated into Chinese, Czech, French, German, Japanese, Korean, Russian, and I'm sure I'm leaving out a few more, about his new book on networks. So let me start with the first question for you. How did you come to be interested in networks in the history of cartography?
I guess I could say that I've always had an interest in networks, although always, you know, presupposes a memory about, you know, back to the age of two, which I would sort of disavow. I collected maps of networks since I was in grade school. I was interested in streetcars. We lived in the city in Baltimore. We didn't have a car yet. If we wanted to go somewhere, aside from taking a taxi, we typically took public transportation. And so you had to note schedules and connections. My dad worked for the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad downtown in an office, and He was involved, I guess, with auditing passenger accounts or something like that. In any event, every so often when they discarded a copy down there of the Official Guide of the Railways, which is a huge book about the thickness of a standard big city telephone book, which has train schedules in it, he'd bring that home, and I was fascinated by it. And I sort of had a railroad hobby. I was also into model trains for a while, at least until one time in high school when I was setting up a layout in our basement. And I got so enthralled with that that I missed the honor roll. And that was a bit of a traumatic experience. And I figured, okay, well, at this point, you know, maybe not so much, you know, spending time with little pieces of track and buildings, but if I want to have an interest in trains, you know, basically look at what schedules and at maps. And the high school that I was going to, which was in downtown Baltimore, Calvert Hall College, it was actually that short for Calvert Hall College Preparatory School, basically a high school, private. It was just across the street from the Enoch Pratt Free Library, the main library in Baltimore. And I had a kind of a nervous problem, I guess, in my senior year, anxiety. And it had to do, no, excuse me, you know, senior year. It had to do with not quite getting calculus. And I got really frustrated and resolved the problem by basically dropping calculus. And I had enough credits that I didn't need it. And the irony of it is that, and this is another long story that's not particularly related to this conversation, but I actually wound up getting a bachelor's in mathematics at Johns Hopkins, where I did my undergraduate work. Any event, this left a bit of a hole in my schedule. That hole in my schedule coincided with actually the lunch period. And since I was a senior, I could go off campus during this long period, and the library beckoned, and I discovered over there something called the Maryland Room, where they had collections of maps, and boy, you know, discovered topographic maps, and you got all kinds of intriguing detail there. So that, I guess, you know, is the origin of my interest in networks. When I was in grad school at Penn State, I even had the idea of doing a master's thesis on railway abandonment. And that idea was scotched by an advisor who didn't really like the idea that much because he had some other things in mind for me. And any event, once I got through the master's, got through the PhD, and then I picked up that topic again, and I actually wrote a little paper that was presented at the Pennsylvania Academy of Science called The Probability of Link Severance in a Transport Network. We actually had a little graphic model showing different phases in which a railroad network might go through, where some links would disappear because they were not as useful as other links. I became interested in another aspect of networks because I was involved early on in digital cartography. And in fact, I guess maybe it was my earliest book, it was called A Computer-Assisted Cartography. And it was actually, I guess, the first general textbook on computerized cartography. I can't really say GIS because there was no GIS at that point. But right. At that time, you know, I did have a chapter that was concerned with computer networks, networks which were represented in the memory of a computer to represent connections between census blocks and addresses and block faces and all kinds of neat stuff, which were used at the time by the U.S. Census Bureau to do two things. One, basically take results from the mail-out, mail-back questionnaire, which was first used for the 1970 census, and assign results to census blocks to expedite tabulation. And then also, for the 1980 census, where they got a little bit more sophisticated with something called DIME, an acronym for Dual Independent Map Encoding. And what they did was to use network representations to make certain that their computerized representation of the network didn't have any glitches in it. So the network linkages actually were used in that way. And then at some point, too, I began to experiment with computer programming for making maps and also dealt with networks in that context. So I guess networks and I go back a long ways.
I'm really struck in the book by a few things that you just mentioned. So in some ways, the prehistory of GIS and the meticulousness of triangulation and geodesic surveyors in the 19th century, by comparison, of course, with the computational mapping and surveying and surveyors' work of the 20th century, of course, you're the editor of the grand volume 6 of the History of Cartography for the 20th century, but could you talk a little bit about some of that kind of mathematical savvy that went into a lot of the survey work and calculations from the 19th century?
Well, triangulation there was very much rooted in trigonometry. And you basically, if you have a network and if you have various stations or you can set up something like a plane table or something maybe a little bit more sophisticated, like a theodolite, where you can get some relatively accurate measurements of angles between stations where the stations would be several miles apart. Typically, you would set the theodolite up at one location. You would have an assistant who would be several miles away. It's almost a male, so I guess there's no problem using a masculine pronoun. Might have a light, and they might even do some of this work at night. And you would have maybe more than one assistant. So what you can do during the daytime, you can have a flag or something like a target. In any event, you're at station A, and you sight on station B, then you sight on station C, and you have this angle ABC in there, and you can get a very precise measurement of that angle. Then you can take the theodolite over to station B, and you can sight back, and you can get, you know, one other angle for that triangle. Then you can go to station C, you can do the same thing. You can have some other stations, you can bring them in. So you basically have a network of triangles. And this doesn't really give you map scale. So there would be a distance that you can measure precisely on the ground. This would be the so-called baseline. And if you have a sort of a high-order triangulation network, there might be a fairly large distance between the stations on the order of, you know, 10, 20, 30 miles. But the baseline would be nowhere near as long. Because trying to get a very precise measurement over a straight line was rather troublesome. In the early days of triangulation in the United States, early in the 19th century, in the early days of the U.S. Coast Survey, they happened to find a stretch of railroad in Massachusetts that was just being built. And so it was going to be a double track railway. They had the track, they had the rails laid along one section, but the adjacent section they hadn't yet put the rails in. And it was in a straight line because this was relatively level land and they graded things very nicely. So this was the setup for the Massachusetts baseline. And the thing there, though, is that in order to measure this, and I have an illustration in the book where they basically had a bar. I mean, this is not a matter of what surveyors would do with a small, relatively localized network, let's say, you know, for a property survey where they might have a steel tape. But they actually had some carefully calibrated bars, multiple bars, and they set up trestles and they would level them off. And you basically would take these bars and you would have them sort of leapfrog along the line and set things up very, very carefully and get an estimate of distance that would be accurate to within a fraction of a centimeter. And by using trigonometry, then, they could take this precisely measured length and integrate it with their network of angles and basically estimate lengths for all of the other sides of triangles in this network. And I have an illustration in the book for the great eastern oblique arc of triangulation that ran from Maine down to Louisiana, a huge network, and they had seven different baselines for this, and things were sort of very carefully integrated in there, and it took a lot of calculation. Bearing in mind, people were doing this using pretty much hand calculation. Slide rules were not really appropriate in this context. They basically used trigonometric tables, logarithmic tables, logarithms. And so they had a great arc of triangulation which ran from Maine down to Louisiana. There were several other extensive triangulation networks. I think was it an arc, I believe, along the 39th parallel that stretched out to California. And this was used to basically frame a lot of local topographic mapping. You had the highly precise first-order triangulation. Then you had a second-order triangulations network, which were linked into the first-order triangulation network. Then you had third-order triangulation networks. So, I mean, it was sort of like, you know, going down a scale. When you went farther down the scale, you got into networks which were more localized. The precision wasn't as great, but the whole thing was tied together by these great arcs. And in the second chapter in my book, which is titled Geometry, I look at another kind of network which was used. And this was a telegraphic network. And the telegraphic network was used to basically integrate latitude and longitude into this system. Bearing in mind, what we have is we have a mapping network which is on a curved surface. And distances, you know, need to be related to something that better approximate this curved surface. And what they did was use something called an ellipsoid. They used the term figure of the Earth, where the three-dimensional Earth was represented not by a sphere, because the Earth is basically sort of like a sphere, but it's flattened at the poles, and because the sphere is spinning, and because central forces are sort of causing it to bulge at the equator, so it gets flattened a bit. And then there's some other sort of dimples here and there. By trying to fit their measurements to different hypothetical so-called ellipsoids, they came up with one that seemed to work pretty well for North America. And they also were using astronomical observations, because basically latitude is a relatively simple measurement, having to do, let's say, with a position relative to the polar star. Longitude becomes trickier. Longitude basically is a difference in time. The Earth is rotating through 360 degrees in a day. 360 degrees in 1 hour is 360 degrees in 24 hours is 15 degrees in 1 hour. And they recognize that you can get some very precise astronomical instruments where you can detect the point at which the Earth, while it is rotating, when you have a star crossing the meridian through a place, and you're observing that star through a very precise telescope, and the heavens are sort of moving, and as the Earth is moving, the star is approaching a line on the telescope, and there's a point at which it crosses. You can have a telegraph key. You can basically click the key, and that would indicate, that would send a signal at the time at which the meridian crossing occurred. You could have this linked to a station somewhere else, where you have another a geodesist, another highly qualified mapping technician, and he would note the time at which this other person's crossing occurred. So you basically would have a time difference. And there were a variety of different corrections that they did here, including a system whereby the two technicians would occupy each other's station, and then they would make the same observations. They would take multiple observations, and they would try to see how consistent these results were. So they got lots of different measurements, and then they would boil these down to a difference in time, which would then become a difference in longitude. And then ultimately, they were able, after we had a transatlantic cable, after the middle, well, I guess what was about 1866 or so, we had a transatlantic cable, they could link in the network of latitude and longitude in Europe with that in North America. And so networks really did play a significant role. You know, if you fast forward to what we have now, where you have a GPS, and that GPS comes up with an estimate of latitude and longitude, which is pretty accurate. It gets even more accurate if you take multiple measurements, because there is still a certain amount of imprecision there. That imprecision that you get in the GPS reading, you know, you might be off by about a meter or two. And this is certainly less than the accuracy that the geodesists had when they were doing their highly precise first-order surveys back in the 19th century. But what you can do, if you're driving around, let's say in a car, and you get this measurement, which might be a little bit off, well, you also have a stored network representing the transportation system, basically the highway system. So you could snap that estimate of latitude and longitude from the GPS onto the nearest roadway or the nearest sidewalk if you're walking. And, you know, here we have a situation where these two networks are sort of helping each other out.
Yeah, I'm very interested, actually, in especially in your first couple of chapters on baselines and geometry, when you begin comparing with some very beautiful mm-hmm. illustrations the different GPS networks, because obviously there is an American GPS network, but as you say, it has competitors. Mm-hmm. There's the Russian network, which was deployed, I think, back in 1996 and then enhanced. And there's the European Space Agency's Global Satellite Navigation System, Galileo. So could you talk a little bit about some of these sort of different, maybe even systems of networks. I know that sounds like a kind of wordy way of understanding this, but there is more than one measure, the American measure of these differential systems. How does that work, let's say, from past into the present today?
Oh, boy. I haven't really looked into it that much, you know, so I have to claim ignorance here, other than the fact that these networks do pretty much the same thing. And these networks were developed as a part of national technical means by the United States. We devised the GPS network originally as a means of routing cruise missiles. And
yes.
And this is the reason why other countries, you know, I mean, especially the Soviet Union, would be obviously using it for their own cruise missile system. It became apparent that there are other applications for GPS. In fact, there was a time at which the American GPS network was deliberately blurred, so that, I mean, if you had a GPS, a receiver, you would be off, you know, not by a meter or so for an instantaneous reading, but it would be off quite a bit. And you could get a better reading if you wanted to by simply occupying that station, you know, for a period of time, and you could get a lot of different measurements, because basically the point that you were trying to measure, its latitude and longitude, if you were to map it, would be jumping around all over the place. But you could take this accumulated set of latitudes and longitudes, and you could average them out, and you could come out to something which would be pretty accurate. That, of course, was not a good system, you know, if you were trying to basically use it for purposes of missile guidance. In any case, you know, where's this going? It's going in the direction that the consumer electronics industry in the United States realized that, hey, you know, there's something here that if we had it, we could sell people GPS receivers that they could have in their cars, and they could link this up with a network map of the highway system. And they could, you know, plug this into, by the way, a shortest path algorithm, so that they could get the shortest distance between an origin and destination, and they could track a vehicle's movement along this digital road network. And there are all kinds of other commercial applications for it, so that basically through the process of lobbying, and also, I guess, a realization that, you know, hey, well, our principal adversary, the Soviets, they also had GPS. So that, you know, if we let the consumer electronics people have access to this, you know, we really, you know, we're not preventing the Russians from being able to guide their own cruise missiles. So basically, the system devised originally for military guidance applications opened up a whole new world of applications. And so the Chinese got into this, and certainly the European Space Agency. And I think the Indians might even have something. I know that they basically put up satellites, and their space program was coming along. In some ways became somewhat of a means of national pride, you know. And I guess the rationalization is, you know, why should the Americans be the only ones to have this technology? It became something where I think they're
Well, I think that and, I think this is yeah. sort of like the history of cartography, volume 7. So,
yeah.
It in many ways remains to be written.
It's evolving.
And it's faster than I can keep up with.
Mm-hmm.
So that's it's really interesting to sort of begin to imagine that history of the future. I want to shift actually back to the history of the 19th and 20th century. So I think the answer it remains to be seen about GPS and satellite navigation. But in your book, it's exceptionally rich to me. The way that you describe roads and power lines and sort of like early planning and infrastructure, like the Erie Canal, the history of the Erie Canal, which became the New York Barge Canal.
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk some more about this network, like sort of pre-20th century history? It's remarkable how you managed to cover a lot of textbooks and sort of engineers and experts who were involved in the process.
The Erie Canal is an interesting case. The topographic maps that they had around in the early 19th century were very general, not overly accurate. Obviously, there was no first-order triangulation network that could tie things down. The measurements were crude. They were generally, useful from the standpoint of representing, where there were rivers. Most of the boundaries that were plotted on those maps, well, if you basically tie a boundary to a river, and assuming there's no confusion about where the river is, you might not be that precise in your representation of the river's geometry, but that probably doesn't make a great deal of difference. There was not much of a road network around then at that point, which was another rationale for having the canal. There really was not a systematic way of training the engineers who were needed to plan and build the canal. In fact, it's been said that the Erie Canal served as North America's first school of engineering. They pretty much learned things as they went. I mean, there were surveying instruments, which had been used there. But how one integrates all of this and systematically surveys the land and figures out, where you're going to get the canal to go. In the absence of detailed topographic maps, surveyors would go out and they would look at things. And one of the big problems was for the surveyor, James Geddes, who was concerned with plotting a route for the canal between, say, roughly around Syracuse to areas south of Rochester, is, where do you put it? And you want to go from the Genesee River, okay, and there was sort of a broad plain that was to the east of the Genesee River, and you want to get a route where you don't want to have too much in the way of ups and downs. Basically, a canal could go across land that was not completely flat because you'd have to build locks. And so you would have the canal's route, and you could have a boat that could go into a lock, and the lot could raise a boat or lower it. But if you had a lot of locks, this added considerably to the cost of construction. It added certainly to the cost of transportation along the canal itself. Geddes traveled around and he looked at the land and he realized that a big problem was crossing the valley of the Garundicut Creek. And he noticed, however, that there was a kind of a feature. There were features that geomorphologists, geographers and geologists who study landforms, recognize as eskers. And an esker is a stream, a deposit left behind by a stream that flowed underneath a glacier. And these streams, when the glacier melted away, left behind a deposit. And the deposits stood up a little higher than the surrounding land. And these eskers were continuous. And Gettys recognized that, okay, there is a place where if we put a large embankment in, we can connect a section of esker on this side with a section of esker on the other side. I'm talking about an embankment, a hill rising up, I think, roughly about 50 feet or so. But constructing something like that over a considerable distance was not an easy task. And the idea is that you could basically get a relatively more or less level route eastward from the Genesee River. There would have to be some locks in there, you know, but it wouldn't be as bad as right. Something where you would have lots of ups and downs. And the canal itself, in the early 20th century, they realized that the canal had some problems. I mean, it had been rebuilt in sections a few times since it was originally opened. I think around maybe 1825 or so, but they decided to give it an overhaul and convert it from the old Erie Canal to the Great New York State Barge Canal, and the canal here would be longer. Would be wider. It would be able to accommodate canal boats that would be longer. They would have locks that would be longer, so you could put these longer boats in them. There would be fewer locks. And so they gave the canal a major overhaul to try to make it more competitive with railways, which I guess, you know, in the long run proved to be fairly short-sighted. The canal itself, it's there and it's operating. And mostly these days, they use it for sometimes shipping some relatively long sections of rotors of windmills, which you can't very well carry on a highway or along a railway. But it's been principally used for tourism on pleasure craft. Railways. Railways, when they were building them, they didn't have the maps of the Geological Survey. The Geological Survey didn't get into the mapping business until the early 1890s. The survey itself was founded in 1879. And how do you route a railway? One of the things, though, is that they could make surveys of stream networks. And by looking at the pattern of streams, they could sort of figure, you know, where you might have ridges that you would have to tunnel through. The railway lines could sort of follow streams. You don't want to do this too much, because the problem is that you have the railway tracks following a stream. You have to build bridges. You have to deal with the occasional flooding. But generally speaking, these rivers, streams, followed routes that were far more amenable to railway transportation, you know, than trying to run a straight line across the land, at least in the eastern part of the country. When you get to the Great Plains, it becomes quite a bit easier.
Right, right. Yeah, and I was really fascinated because I think in some ways when you're describing the history of the canal and railways, the watchwords are for a very long period of time, maybe a century and a half, modernization and restructuring and progress and development. But, you know, so much has been written really starting with Matthew Edney's essay back, I think, 1993 on writing the history of cartography, not just from the angle of progress. So I want to lead maybe not so seamlessly into the latter chapters of your book, where, you know, at one point you say behind every great map is a network and behind every great network is a map. From there, we wind up into the theme or the story of control. So not just surveillance, but actual control. Could you talk about that? It seems to be the future of a lot of things that you bring up in this book and in your other books about the military and surveillance, gerrymandering. You have a fascinating part about that with the 2016 election. So the issue of control and leading into a world where progress is no longer the way to write about the history of maps and cartography.
Okay. Let me start by looking at driverless cars, or as I guess some people like to call them, autonomous vehicular systems. There are things out there right now. I mean, there apparently, you know, are Teslas on the road, which allegedly, you know, somebody is at the control of these, but people have photographed the, you know, car going by 65, 70 miles an hour, and the person at the wheel seems to be asleep, and they haven't hit things. And the technology is there. I mean, you can put sensors in a car so that it doesn't get too close to the vehicle in front of it. You can keep track of the lines along the roadway so that it can be prevented from drifting out of its lane. You can presumably set things up so that you can basically start it out and you can program it and you can presumably, in theory at least, take it to its destination. And ultimately, I think this kind of thing is going to come to pass. You could probably say that as long as the vehicles on the road are following the same algorithm and you don't have, you know, some of them, you know, which have, let's say, programming that would make them excessively more aggressive than some other vehicles, things would work very precisely. We do have, you know, a system that is networked because we have the existing infrastructure of the highway networked because we have the satellite navigation network, which is keeping track of the instantaneous location of the vehicle, which can also, by the way, provide you a much better indication of its speed than an odometer, which is simply, you know, tied to an axle. You have a network that can basically describe the highway system, that could describe, let's say, where the vehicle is going to turn. There are all kinds of ways in which control can be programmed into this. And this could be very useful, too, from the standpoint you can avoid a problem we've had periodically in Syracuse. We have a road which goes along the northeast side of Onondaga Lake Parkway. And there's a railway bridge. And the bridge has, I forget exactly what the elevation is, but it does have an elevation which is sufficiently low so that occasionally it crops off the top of a tractor trailer because the driver is not very attentive. And there was a problem a number of years ago where, you know, these double-decker buses where they operate express bus service, one going, I think, between New York City and Toronto. And they're supposed to go over a prescribed route. Well, the driver got lost, and he had his own GPS along. And his GPS was, I guess, the kind, you know, which works perfectly well in a car. And it gave him a route, and it sent him along Onondaga Lake Parkway. And this happened late at night, and I guess he wasn't terribly attentive to the signs. And they have loads of signs approaching this. And basically, he rammed the bus into the railway bridge. And that's a very durable bridge. It's endured, I'd say, probably it must be by this point upwards of maybe 30 or 40 different crashes over the years. There seemed to be a few of them every year. And unfortunately, it took out the upper part of the bus and several people died. And so, you know, if the bus operator had a GPS system, and I guess you can't anticipate things, you probably can now, that would actually keep track of the momentary position of the bus along its route and detect any departure of the bus from the prescribed route. And conceivably, if there's a problem and if human lives are at stake, shut down the bus, you know, which is better than, you know. Now, this applies to buses. It also applies to trains. The railway system in the country is going through some fits and starts in implementing something called positive train control. And positive train control uses GPS. It uses the network of the rail lines themselves where you have the tracks. It uses telecommunication networks that also transmit information between control stations, which are trackside, and the operator's cab, and it can do a number of things, including if a train is approaching another train, and if they're on the train same track, it can avoid a serious rear end a collision, and this is a good thing. It can also identify situations where there is a misaligned switch, and this can be a good thing. It can also identify a situation that happened a few years ago near Philadelphia, where an engineer became distracted, and I don't fully understand what went on, but he basically was not aware fully of where he was, and he was on a curve, and this is a curve where he should have slowed down. And he basically accelerated the train to something like 60 or 70 miles an hour. He went into the curve, and basically the train flew off the track.
Right. I have to say, Mark, because you had this wonderful passage in the book where you ask if a car's computer, like the black box on airplanes after they crash, if the computer should be allowed to testify against the driver. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a brilliant idea. If you're doing a kind of forensic test, mm-hmm. It's a question of liability and other things, and also intersects with privacy issues for the 21st century. So that's a great way of looking at this, you know, future of drone and surveillance technology that I think we will all have increasingly as militaries grow and police departments continue to use them. So I want to really turn to my last sort of big question here. And given all of this history of science, technology, engineering, mathematics, I have to ask a political question. And the political questions that you raised toward the end of the book about gerrymandering and other issues, do you see in the near future, since you have been talking a lot about the development of these technologies, the ability of citizen mappers or cartographers or ordinary practitioners of GIS, do you see them as capable of reining in the politics, this kind of partisan gerrymandering that you described that's really kind of gotten out of control?
Well, I mean, at one level, as long as we have the Electoral College in the United States, we have a structural gerrymander which can produce a result such as we had in 2016, where Hillary Clinton, I think, had upwards of 3 million more votes than Trump, and Trump won. And he won in the Electoral College because basically he had supporters who managed to carry the edge in states like Wisconsin. I have a friend in Wisconsin, and I am furious with her for throwing away her vote by voting for Jill Stein. You can get a slight margin here and there, and you can rack up more electoral votes that can negate a significant win in the count of popular votes. So that's one thing. Another thing is what happens when we come to legislation. And, well, as far as the Senate is concerned, the structural gerrymander that basically put Trump in the White House is still likely to give Republicans a slight edge in the Senate. Whether the Democrats can take things back or not, it's hard to say. You know, one would think that under the natural tenor of things, people who, you know, might be leaning toward the right of center would be so disgusted with what's coming out of the White House now that they would simply not want that to continue. Or, you know, conceivably the Republican Party might go for somebody halfway decent like Nikki Haley. But if we look at Congress and we have two houses, we have the Senate, we have the House of Representatives. And the House of Representatives is very susceptible to gerrymandering, insofar as you can take a state and you can draw the lines within the state, and you can take the other party's voters and you could marginalize them by drawing lines that basically put, let's say, more Democrats in relative few districts, or if you're in the state of Maryland and the Democrats, and if they're controlling things, they can do the same darn thing that the Republicans do. They can put most of the Republicans or the Republican strength, let's say, in one district and let the Democrats take the other districts. What can be done about this? Well, I see two things that can be done. You know, one is that you can go with the system that we have pretty much now, but we can get more voices at the table. And you can use crowdsourcing, and you can let average everyday citizens and people basically come up with their own redistricting plans, and they can present these plans, and they can let a legislature look at different possibilities, and maybe not just a legislature, but a so-called bipartisan or let's say nonpartisan redistricting commission look at various possibilities. But through crowdsourcing, I mean, you can take a state and there can be umpteen different ways in which you can redistrict that state. And all of them can satisfy the one person, one vote rule. Right. But some of them right. can give a significant advantage to one party or the other. Now, you can also say, why do we simply have to have this practice of single member districts? Why can't we recognize that you can take several of our existing congressional districts and make them into a multi-member district, combine them, so that the district will send two or three or four people to the U.S. House? Now, how do you do this? Well, you don't want to do it so that voting within that district basically gives people, gives the candidate the possibility of the so-called first-past-the-post victory. What you do is you allow something like proportional ranked choice voting. And everybody in the district, you know, would receive a slate of candidates, and you could rank them. most preferred to least pre-preferred. And the idea behind this is that you basically want to let more people within the district at least influence one of the seats assigned to this district. Now, another advantage of that, well, let's see, I'm sort of getting ahead of me. This is possible. You might say, well, doesn't it make for a very complicated ballot? Sure. But we do have electronic computers now. People could basically mark a ballot. There could be, you know, ways in which you could basically reduce the number of people who might qualify, you know, for this ballot. But, you know, I don't think that kind of complication, it's certainly not something which would be impossible from the standpoint of determining, you know, how you're going to count votes using something called the single transferable vote. I don't want to get into the complications of that.
However, an excellent answer, really, and I have to sort of cut you off on that one.
Oh, but that's a shame. Because one thing, let me
30 seconds.
You don't have to redistrict every year. You can basically recognize that there are certain districts within a state that are going to be pretty stable because we have a network of urban centers. And so we have in New York State, say maybe something centered in the western part of the state, something centered on Rochester, something in the central part. There's a big district center down toward New York City. We can have stable boundaries. Populations within these boundaries can change, but you can then adjust the votes that the various members from these districts might have because you can give them a vote which is sort of like shares of stock that would be represented by people in a corporate boardroom. Okay, I quit now on that. Sorry. I did want to get that in.
I know you have another book in you about this topic. I can absolutely feel it. But I've got to ask, and this is really the last question now, what you're working on now after your latest book. So if you would, please.
Okay. Right now I'm working on a biography of a chap by the name of John Byron Plato. And as you can imagine, by the way, if you try and do a Google search for him, you're going to really wind up with a lot of stuff that's not particularly relevant. Plato came to light in my book on patents and cartographic inventions because he devised a system for assigning addresses in rural areas that would give farmers a real address, to use his term, just like city folk, and a real address that could be posted on their mailbox, a real address unlike RFD numbers, which don't really have any meaning. Other than to a letter carrier, a real address where you indicate roughly how far they are in miles from an address hub, such as a community center, such as a rural business center. And he devised something called the clock system, which looks at the 12 hour hands of the clock. And there's a sector which would be 12 o'clock, then 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, and so forth. So that basically you have these 12 sectors laid out around these various center points. And you say that a farmer is, let's say, at 3 o'clock in ring 3 from Huntington Village. Okay. Plato patented his system, hence he got into the book on cartographic patents. He decided he would try to sell the system to the post office. Well, that didn't work. The bureaucrats didn't want to try something new. And he decided he basically would go into business, and he came to Ithaca, New York. And he set up a company which for about a decade and a half made clock system maps. And he came to Ithaca in 1918, and he left around 1931 when the Great Depression came on and sort of undermined his business. This is the first bibliography that I've done, not bibliography, excuse me, biography. Sorry, I confuse these terms. Biography is very different from the other works I've done.
Right.
A biography is a life of an individual, and there are lots of facts involved. And it's a matter of trying to connect the dots, but to connect the dots, you first have to find those dots. And Plato left a very spotty biographical footprint. Fortunately, he talked to journalists, so you can find various newspaper articles that mentions him, and he's talking about what he's planning on doing. You can find his pattern of copyrights. You can find a problem, however, because when you register a copyright, you deposit two copies with the copyright office. You make the assumption that those copyright deposit copies, at least one of them, is going to find its way into the Library of Congress. Not necessarily so. There's some, I would say that a substantial part of the cartographic heritage, the low-end cartographic heritage of this country, went into waste bins or landfills or incinerators. I'm going to write an article at some point that I call it the Cartographic Holocaust.
Wow.
Wow.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you. We've been talking with Mark Monmonier, professor at Syracuse University and the Maxwell School of Citizenship and Public Affairs. This is your host, Stephen Siegel, on New Books in Geography, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. Mark's new book is called Connections and Content: Reflections on Networks and the History of Cartography. It is published this September by Esri Press. Thanks, Mark, for joining us on the podcast today.
And thanks for having me on the program, Stephen.